For anyone who hasn't read the book, could you give us a kind of really brief thumbnail sketch of the story of the Motunui Epa?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to show the cover of the book. So these are the carvings that the book's about, and they once formed the back wall of a pātaka or storehouse. So this was a structure that was really important in the old world. They were structures that stored precious goods and foods and so on. And it was made in the mid-1700s by master carvers. That building was dismantled probably 1820 around that time, and the carvings were placed in a swamp for safekeeping. In that time, there was it's the so-called musket wars. Guns had arrived in New Zealand, actually all via Australia. I just read the other day that there were 20,000 muskets traded between Sydney and New Zealand, so-called, between 1820 and 1835. It was a massive arms trade. Anyway, these carvings were placed in the swamp for safekeeping. The aim was that they would be retrieved once the troubles had passed, but the intertribal wars were then followed by the wars of colonisation and Taranaki, and no one came back. So my book really begins in 1971 when the carvings emerged from the swamp and were found illegally sold, smuggled out of the country, and bought by a guy called George Ortiz, who was an enormously wealthy man who collected art from the Pacific. And they would have really stayed hidden. No one would have known about this illegal deal if it wasn't for the fact that one of George's kids got kidnapped by Italian radicals and he had to raise a ransom. So then the carvings were put up for auction. And my book really documents the extraordinary chain of events that led to their fake provenance being revealed and then the government's efforts to retrieve them. That's the story of the book, I guess.
How did you come to invest several years of your life in writing this history?
You know, I'm an Uriu, a descendant of Taranaki, and really from 2000 on, my life and work has been completely tied up with exploring what that means. So it's a complete driving force in my life, you know, and so everything kind of flows in behind that. And I just saw these carvings at the Pukeariki Museum in 2019 and was really fascinated. I'd heard a little bit about the repatriation that the government had paid $4.5 million to buy these carvings back, which is pretty unusual in itself that stolen goods would be bought back. But yes, the absolute beauty and power of the carvings or taonga tupuna, which means treasured ancestors, really, really struck me. And then I just sort of started to ask a few questions. So it wasn't a planned thing. It was more like taking a few steps. One of my mentors, Mahara Okiroa, sounding board's the wrong word really, but someone I like to talk to about things. And I said, what do you reckon about these carvings? And we just talked about it a bit and I got the feeling it would be okay. I mean, I'm pretty careful what I take on. I try not to just stumble in too much, but at the same time, if you're working in the Māori world, you need to be cautious, but you also need to be bold. So I was both things, I think. I was cautious and then I decided, no, I'm going to pursue this story. And one of my relatives, Honiana Love, who's a friend, she also helped me. She said, why don't you make an Official Information Act request? That's called FOI here. So that's really when I started getting access to all the paper records. And I became really fixated is probably the right word. I remember when I first saw the records at Crown Law, when I saw that there were land court records in the box. So New Zealand has two jurisdictions. There's a separate court that governs Māori land. So that's a different system of ownership, which is collective. And it's the only land court in the world that's based on genealogy. And I recognise those records because my whānau or family also has land that's through that system. So that, I think, I had enough knowledge, just a little bit, to recognise the importance of what I was looking at. And it was really fascinating to see those lists of names of owners of so-called Māori freehold land alongside all these documents like the House of Lords finding and all these legal documents. It really, I felt that it was worlds colliding just even in those archival records. That's what guided me, that sense of these absolutely colliding worlds, you know, quite unexpected. And it wasn't just a story of the New Zealand government doing something. There were undercurrents already there in the paper records.
How did you go about making sense of it all? And how, I suppose, did you supplement the archive of the colonial state with other kind of, you know, Maori and other perspectives?
It was really hard to piece together what was happening. That was a lot of reading. And then I would just have these conversations with Matua Mahara and another relative, Uncle John Baxter, and my sister Hannah And I'd talk through the things I was finding and then trying to figure out what we thought it meant. I've sort of, that sounds like a silly answer in a way, but I kept coming up against things that I couldn't explain and we couldn't explain collectively. So when I started, I did this really detailed timeline of events in 1978, day by day, because it was only about 26 days from the time the New Zealand government discovered that the provenance of these carvings was fake to them getting this injunction to stop the sale. Now, the public service does not normally move that fast. And this involved massive cooperation between foreign affairs, between Crown Law, between the Department of Internal Affairs, and it was just quite unprecedented. And at the same time that that was all happening, the Conservative government, which was led by Robert Muldoon, ordered the invasion of Bastion Point. So that was when the land rights movement was really resurgent in New Zealand, and that's land in Auckland, and the army forcibly evicted people that were peacefully protesting. So that happened. Cabinet signed a memo that authorised as much money to be spent as possible to get these carvings back. And then there was also arrests of Eva Rickard, who's a Tainui. She was a kuia involved in land rights protests in Raglan. So I just couldn't, it was really bizarre to me. And I started thinking, I guess that forces were at work beyond what I could really understand. It just didn't seem to make sense that this very conservative government that wasn't really known for its pro-Māori views was taking this action.
What do you think now was the reason, you know, that explains why that happened?
Well, not to get too spiritual, but I do just think that this was an example of the sovereign power of Taranaki itself. So whether you want to say that's the maunga or the mountain or the place or... I feel that I often thought when I was working on this book, did colonization really happen? Was there a sense that there was just such a strong through line of power from the old world that I saw? So that's why I decided, I suppose, that some of the book, that there would be this other intelligence in the book, and that would be that the carvings themselves or those tūpuna themselves. I mean, yes, that's what I thought. It just, you know... to take that action all the way to the House of Lords, and for that to be happening at the same time as the first Waitangi Tribunal claims in New Zealand, and that one of those early claims was for stopping sewage outfall and sin fuel outfall into the river right by where the carvings were buried. They were the same places. So I just found that that seemed to be beyond serendipity.
The way in which you feature the Motunui Epa as, you know, kind of animate characters in their own right. You talk about them having agency over the process, and you sort of inhabit their consciousness and talk about, you know, how they felt being in storage in a dark box, what they think of certain individuals who come to look at them. Could you tell us a bit more about the decision to animate the epa and write the history in that way?
Yeah, I grew up in Taranaki, so I was a school kid in New Plymouth. And, you know, I remember going to the, it was called the Taranaki Museum then, and we saw lots of beautiful things. We would see all these carvings in glass boxes, and I remember looking at the white labels, and there was never any name against the person who made it. And then it would always be said like, found in a swamp, found in a drain, found in a ditch. And I remember being really young and feeling, you know, the things that you find in a drain is the stuff you throw away, isn't it? I mean, that's the sort of, you know, it's something that you, as a child, you throw something, a leaf in the drain and watch it flow down the gutter. And there was I was always really puzzled by that, why these precious things would have just been left. And now, of course, as an adult, I realised that, they weren't thrown, they were carefully placed in spots that were known for their preserving powers. But then I wanted to sort of go, so there was that was the first basic thing. But then it was also thinking about the world of art and the importance of makers and biographies and identities attached to famous artists. So, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Old Masters. And I just kept thinking about all those European artists that many of us, I guess, have studied at school or university, and when people visit Europe, they see them all. But even in New Zealand, someone like Colin McCann, who's our big name white guy painter. Now, why are their names and identities attached to that? And then you have a masterpiece, you know, you have work like this. And there's no names attached to it and there's not really any biography, but does that mean there's not power? You know, what do I do with that absence? Do I just sit back and accept that it's not known and feel shameful? Or do I go, well, okay, there is a power there and I'm going to think about that. You know, we believe that carvings are people returned. I mean, that's what we believe. And I really had that demonstrated to me a few years ago. My dad, who passed away in 2017, was a paediatrician, and he founded the Māori Health Committee of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians and is represented in a carved po that's in the offices in Wellington. And, you know, one of my kids was like, oh, my God, has Paleo been 3D printed? And I'm like, yeah, well, sort of like that. So it was just, I guess, I'm giving a sort of wide-ranging answer. I thought I'd give it a go, trying to not put myself in there, but to have another perspective commentating on events, another version of events. And that perspective would be the Taranaki one, you know, not the crown and not me as a historian here, but this different perspective. And I just started experimenting, you know, and the first bit I did was trying to think about talking about the Ortiz family and the Patinos and all that, where their wealth came from, the Bolivian tin magnates. So it's just such an amazing story in itself. And, you know, back home in New Zealand, when you meet people for the first time, there's sort of, it can be that quite a ritual encounter where you learn about who they are and who their people are. So that second chapter, inheritance, that's really what I started doing, imagining that the carvings were really empowered to meet this whānau from very far away and trying to find connections with them. So that was probably the start of doing something different. I mean, it's all factually based. I did a large amount of research and I just thought, how would I present the story of this family? Who might be, you know, how might they be measured as people? And I felt that I tried to measure them from a Taranaki perspective.
You know, it's challenging kind of orthodoxies of Western storytelling. You know, it's very poetic. It often felt like sort of you were evoking sort of oral storytelling techniques. Like I felt like someone was holding me by the hand and kind of walking me through this story. Mm. And another really distinctive feature of the text is the use of Maori language.
My first go at learning Maori was when I was 18, you know, after Polytech. So did that with my dad, an immersion course with Te Huirangi Waikiri Piru. So Wairata, there might be some others on the line who recognise that name. He was the person who took the Māori language claim all the way to the Privy Council, actually. So anyway, that's a whole amazing man. I'm a failed linguist. I keep trying, but that didn't stop me. I didn't let myself be limited. I didn't let myself in any way say, because I can't speak fluent Māori, I can't do this. Or because I'm not living in New Zealand, I really just let all of that drop away. And I thought, I am going to do this with what I know. So it's interesting that, you know, you say, or others, oh, there's lots of Māori words in the text. And then it's like, oh, you must speak fluently. It's like, my knowledge is so scant, yet compared to, you know, it depends who you're measuring it against. One thing I would like to say about the book is it's, you know, it's a three-dimensional object and it represents a huge renaissance or change in my own whānau or family. So the book opens with a poem by our relative J.C. Sturm. And J.C. Sturm is an incredible poet. So this is at the museum on Pukeahu and it's in English. There's a few Māori phrases in that poem. But the book closes with Kupu Whakakapi composed by my sister Hannah, who is a fluent Māori speaker. So to me, this is actually about renewal and abundance, that within our own whānau, what had been lost. So our direct ancestor was a translator at Pariaka. Like, he was incredibly skilled in both worlds. And within about, you know, it didn't take long for that to be destroyed. But, you know, my youngest brother, Joseph, I'm the oldest of eight, he's also a fluent speaker now. So that is an incredible thing that's occurred within our whānau. So I suppose that the book's also about that, Eve, is that colonisation, yes, there was mass destruction in Taranaki and so much was lost, but there's still so much growth, you know, even amongst that. And, you know, it's wonderful to speak to you on the eve of tomorrow, as I mentioned, when I emailed earlier, the settlement's been finalised for the Taranaki Maunga. So, wow, who would have thought that when I was a kid or even 10 years ago, that the name Egmont would be gone forever? It's gone. wow, you know. So it's, I guess that's the other thing about this book and these amazing carvings, is it just shows me you never know when the story's over. It never really is over. And in Australia, you know, for Australians, there's all those visual metaphors of burnt trees with the little green growth, isn't there? So that's what I think about Māori. Like, a little bit, even something is better than nothing, right? And, you know, there's no, I realise that for Australian readers it's hard. There's not translations in brackets and there's no glossary. And I'm sorry if that's a challenge for you, but in thinking about that, you know, books like Cormac McCarthy, some of you may have read The Crossing. I read that, and that was liberal in its use of Spanish with no translation. And likewise, you know, there's that amazing book I've just read, Deborah Dank, We Come With This Place. And that really uses her language and English interchangeably. And I like it. I think it's good. But you can look up, if you want to know what the Māori words mean, there's a good online dictionary. So you can just Google it up as you go, if it's a trouble for you. Yeah.
At what point did you decide with the publisher to kind of have it so lavishly illustrated?
And I have to say, Eve, it was just such an enormous amount of work. I was involved a lot and was able to exert some good influence. I wanted archival records as images, and it took a while to get that accepted, that I thought that they would work really well. I had to put my foot down and say I refused to have any images produced in the 19th century by soldiers. I was not going to have any representations of the war in Taranaki that were made by Pākehā people. So that pretty much wipes out any representation of the war. All visual imagery is produced by violent colonising agents, literally soldiers or surveyors. And I just said, no, I'm not having it. And I was really insistent on it. I was like, I'd rather have a blank page than images produced by others looking in. I mean, there is, I shouldn't be so dogmatic because I love being dogmatic, but there is a drawing by Charles Heafy of a pātaka, which is really beautiful. And that's in there. So once you wipe out that, then you have to start thinking quite differently about what the images would be.
The story ends with the New Zealand government finally managing to buy back the Motunui Epa from the Ortiz family and spending several million dollars to do so, but then to kind of give them back to the Taranaki, which sort of, you know, seems like a kind of rare instance of a colonial state engaging in a kind of reparations, maybe, for like the stuff they stole in the first place. Has that kind of thing happened elsewhere, and could it be a model that could be replicated more broadly, do you think?
I do think the story is quite unique. I don't know of any other instances where it's happened in New Zealand in quite the same way. I feel that this was a bit unique. I certainly imagine if the Australian government bought back everything that had been taken from here, that would just be, you'd have to have a fortune to pay. And, you know, there is that deeper question of, should you pay a thief to retrieve stolen goods? I mean, you know, if someone stole your car, would you pay them to get it back? That's putting it pretty crudely. I don't know if it's a model. I mean, I think that it's really great that this has happened. I think there's so much more that can be done to connect people with their past, with our pasts, with our treasures, and to create narratives around them so that we're building meaning. You know, we're really saying, this is ours, and what can we, I feel very connected to these tupuna, even though I don't know their names, and I feel very connected to the people who made them in a way, actually, and their power to keep acting in the present, you know. And I'm really proud that laws in New Zealand certainly changed as a result of this theft. You know, the Protected Objects Amendment Act, I document that, and the Commonwealth Law Scheme. I mean, there's been a lot of impact that's broader than just these carvings. And I was just actually back in Taranaki about 4 weeks ago. I gave a talk at All Waimarae and went and called in to visit the Epa, and it felt really great. Like, I mean, they just felt very alive to me. At the start of 2020, I went in for about 10 days every day just to spend some time in there. And I often felt pretty depressed. It was often a bit of a sad feeling. You know, I was interviewed by this amazing writer, Airana Nariwa. He's a novelist, actually. His first book is called The Bone Tree. It's just come out. And we went up to visit the carvings together. And Airana is a beautiful Māori speaker. And he mihied or greeted the carvings at length. And I felt a little bit whakama, not a little bit. I was sort of stood behind him, but it was beautiful hearing he was able to communicate, you know, that was beautiful. That's what he could do, and I can do something different. So, yeah, hopefully I think I've done okay. That's, yeah.